Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. My name is Lisa A. Romano, and I am the Long Island Life Coach, and I'm an ACOA advocate and emotional recovery specialist. Essentially, what I do is I help people recover from the wounds that were created as when people were children, the children of parents who were self-absorbed and alcoholics. And what I want to do today is talk a little bit about what happens when we are these small children who have these extremely self-absorbed, narcissistic-type parents as role models. What happens is it is a parent's job to mirror back to a child a sense of self. But when mom and dad are alcoholics or they're addicted to painkillers or they're having affairs and they're lost in those distractions, and or they're gamblers or whatever, they have anxiety and they're not able to be present fully emotionally in the now for us as children. We are, and as children, children are always in the now. But when our parents are unable to connect to us in the here and the now, we get infused with the sense that we're not enough. That disconnect that we feel, we absorb into our beings as to mean that we are not enough. Mommy and daddy can't connect to me, so there must be something wrong with me. We have no concept of alcoholism and addiction, painkillers, the need for distractions. We have no idea of dysfunction. All that we know is that we want to connect to mom and or dad or both, and we aren't. We can feel it. And so what happens is our little minds presume we're not good enough. And unless that feeling or that notion is confronted in adult life, what ends up happening is that becomes our framework and our foundation for all future endeavors. So what happens to a young man who grows up with this sense that he's not enough? He may feel, or due to his programming and conditioning, based on what he experienced in his environment, he may feel that sexual conquest is the way to feel enough. And of course, a string of affairs, of broken relationships, and perhaps children different mothers, and yada yada yada. You know, a string of those types of relationships. And at the end of his life, he's still not fulfilled, and can't figure out why. Having all these women in his life still has not infused him with a sense of feeling enough. Or this young man goes out into life and he thinks that making money is the key to feeling enough. Maybe if I have enough money, then I will feel enough. Maybe if I have a nice car, then I'll feel enough. Maybe if I have the biggest house in the block, then I'll feel enough. And of course, you know, emptiness keeps showing up. And young women, they go out into the world and feeling not enough. And so what do? They seek love in all the wrong places. And maybe if I'm thin enough, I'll be good enough. And so we have young girls that have this web-like idea, this very gossamer-type veil of an idea that has them thinking that their worth is outside of themselves, and that they and because of the media, the way it is, the message is that, yeah, being thin, extremely thin, means you're good enough. And so you have a young woman who senses this emptiness, and she's presuming, based on what the information she's getting from the outside, that being thin will make her feel good enough. So then we have a situation where a child like that may go and begin sticking her fingers down her throat in an attempt to feel good enough. But then she develops bulimia and an addiction to food and an aversion to food. And then this terrible cycle of binging and purging is something that she can't break. She gets caught up inside of it. Or what about when little girls that go out into life and think, well, if I have a string of boyfriends, then I'll finally be enough. And then she gets labeled a whore because she's promiscuous and she's having these strings of relationships looking for love, you know, to make her feel seen, to make her feel valid, and it never shows up. And that's the result of being raised by two people who can't and will not see us because of their own personal issues. If we as adults, or even young adults, don't confront where our true wounding comes from, then we set out in life basically on a corrupted blueprint. And nothing that we can attract into our experience is ever going to make us feel enough, because the program, the data is corrupt. You can never seek happiness from the outside. But today I want to talk about how we, unaware codependents, in the beginning of this, as adults, how we end up manipulating people into our experience. So what happens is a lot of adults who are unaware, who are adult children of alcoholics, who are unaware that their needs have not been met, and are unaware that they're truly responsible for their own needs to get met, and just don't know how to get their own needs met. They don't know how to love themselves enough to go out and take that dance class. They don't feel worthy of taking that dance class. Dance classes are for pretty girls or women who love themselves. They're not for us. You know, they don't know how to go out there and finish college. College is for other people, people that are worthy of good jobs. Not for ACOAs, not for people who don't feel worthy, for people who don't feel enough. So what ends up happening is we unaware adult children of alcoholics don't seek those things that make us happy. If anything, we pinch ourselves off from getting those things that make us happy and going after them because we're insecure and we don't feel that we're worthy of the end result of those types of actions. And so what we do, There's no blame, there's just observation, because if we can't see it, we can't heal it. But what we tend to do very early on in our adulthood, we begin to enter into relationships expecting others to meet those needs that our parents never met. So we unconsciously manipulate people into our lives and secretly, below the veil, expect them to do everything we want them to do as a way to secure they never abandon us. We control them, we manipulate them, we lie to them, and we pretend we have their best interest at heart, especially at the beginning of the relationships. However, below the gossamer's veil, in the pools of the unconscious mind, our unconscious mind breathes the unfortunate truth. Recovering from codependency is not for the average Joe or Susie Schmo. It takes guts of steel to face what we have done and to swallow the reality that we are learning to accept we created. While most people are out there in life and blaming others for why they drink or for why they behave inappropriately, for we recovering codependents who have finally awakened, we are learning to understand that our personal truth can set us free. That means being able to heal codependency means that we're able to see how our unconscious programming caused us to attract unhealthy people into our lives. So what do? We attract people into our lives that we can fix. Not for their benefit, but for ours, because unconsciously we think if we can get this other person to need us, they will never leave us. Now, I really want people to hear that. What codependents do is they attract people into their experience that they feel they can fix. Why? It is not for the other person's benefit. It never is. That's the illusion. And that's the illusion that keeps people stuck. Codependents attract people into their lives that they can fix so that they can instill in the other person the sense that that person needs them. Why? So that they never leave them, so that they never abandon them. And that's what codependents do unconsciously. Why? Because we settle for being needed rather than loved. Why? Because we don't believe that we're worthy of love. Why? Because our parents never infused us with the sense of love and the sense of self that they were supposed to. It was their job. But when you're inebriated and you're dysfunctional, your priorities are inappropriate. Becoming drunk is your priority. Escaping reality is your priority. There's no priority to this little boy or this little girl that you've brought into this world to ensure that their happiness is guaranteed, to ensure that they feel seen, to ensure that they feel heard. No. What do alcoholic parents do? They ignore us. They try to control us. They minimize us. They tone us down. They tell us that we're crazy. If we act out, they label us as being the bad one, but we never acknowledge their alcoholism. We get labeled for being crazy and for being boisterous and for acting out or for being the problem child because we are reacting to the loneliness and to the abandonment. We are the most emotionally honest, and so we get labeled while our parents continue drinking. And they're very clever. You know, alcoholics can appear to be sober, especially if they've been drinking a long time. And they're very clever and very manipulative with their speech. And so, you know, you confront an alcoholic, they you know, with their drinking and say, you know, it's inappropriate. Your child doesn't feel seen. Well, we have a personality conflict. That's why my kid doesn't feel seen. Well, you don't know how my kid talks to me. Well, you don't know how my kid acts. You don't know how he treats his brothers and sisters. And all this other stuff, which is a smokescreen to get the focus off of the real issue, which is the addiction to alcohol and the abuse of alcohol. And so what happens is this type of the cycle just flourishes inside a home, you know, where alcoholism is at the root of the problem, but nobody confronts it. No one says, you know, daddy's an alcoholic and he has an addiction and that's why our house is falling apart. Mommy has her head in the clouds and is enabling daddy, and rather than set boundaries with him, she's yelling at the kids, don't get your father upset. And what does that do? That upsets the child. Why? Because now do we not only have to walk around on eggshells, now we have to stuff whatever the hell it was we were feeling. Maybe we had a bad day at school. Maybe we were getting picked on. Maybe our teacher harassed us that day. Maybe our boyfriend, you know, said something that was a lie about us. And we have all this emotional gobbledygook going on inside of us, and we go home and we need someone to talk about. But dad's passed out on the couch, mom's cooking dinner, and she's aggravated. And so we walk into this dynamic, the air is so thick we can feel it, and we know we have no one to talk to about what's going on. And worse, your mother, glances at you, she gives you this glare, and you know, shut your mouth. Don't open your mouth. Don't upset your father. Your father's drunk. I mean, it's an insane way to live. And that's, I'm not even introducing physical abuse or sexual abuse into the dynamic. That happens every day in this country and all over the world, where children are being taught to shut up, to sit down, and to stuff their feelings for the sake of the dysfunctional parenting that the parents that are in the home. So what do? Unfortunately, when we're children, we really are stuck. We really are victims. We really are, you know, hogtied, because this is our reality. There are things that we can do, you know, and that's what's so wonderful about Blog Talk Radio, and so wonderful about, you know, websites like my own and others, many, many others, and, you know, WordPress and Blogger and tons and tons of free information that's and online communities that are available not only to adults but to children. Self-esteem workshops right online. YouTube is a great resource for helping children who feel stuck and literally are stuck. And for a moment, I'd like to talk to those children out there who may have tuned into this radio show, perhaps by accident. Number one, it's not an accident. Nothing's coincidence in this world. If you were attracted to this radio broadcast, then you are meant to hear it. Or you are meant to share it with someone in your life that knows needs to hear it. So I want to talk to those kids who, like me, were one day stuck. You know, when I was a young kid, I really didn't see a way out of my situation. And when I was about 12 years old, I thought, I'm done. Like, I don't want to live anymore. This sucks, you know. I have to pretend that I don't feel what I feel. I'm being bullied at home. My brother hates me because my dad keeps comparing him to me, and I was a good student. My brother, unfortunately, you know, had some academic, you know, problems, you know. I excelled, and he just couldn't get his stuff together. And so my dad would compare the two of us, and he definitely drove a wedge between us. So, yes, my brother grew up envious and jealous of me, but I understood why. Even at a young age, I understood why. But I was powerless. I was a child. That was my mom's responsibility to put her foot down and say, hey, stop driving a wedge between the kids. You know, stop talking to your son that way. Stop comparing them. You know, deeper than that, it was my father's job to not do that. It was my dad's job to be encouraging rather than being critical. I mean, truly overly critical and in control of his feelings. He was never in control of his feelings, you know, and he would expect us to control our feelings, but he couldn't control his own. He would expect us to control our spending or to control, you know, drinking or control eating, and he couldn't control his own. it was bizarre. It was upside down, and it made me feel like I was inside out. Like, I felt raw all the time. And so I was bullied at home, and so I went into, I felt very, very nervous all the time and anxious and raw, like my flesh was ripped open. And so when I went to school, I felt the need already to protect myself from others, and I didn't realize that by going in afraid and by going in feeling infected, I was literally like a beacon for bullying. It was like I had a sign across my forehead that said, make fun of me, like pick on me. And I didn't realize it. I didn't go into school happy, lighthearted. I went into school tapped in and tuned into and turned on to everything that was wrong. I was hypervigilant. I was aware of every look and every glare and every negative nuance. I couldn't shake it. I attracted it. And I know that now, but then I didn't. Actually, what happened to me was when I went to school and I got bullied, it actually affirmed for me that I was a victim. It actually made, and so when I got picked on, I would say, see, I'm a victim. See, I got picked on today. See, I'm a bully. See, the world sucks. And I really wasn't aware that it was my hypervigilance to things that I didn't want to happen that was actually at the core of creating and attracting into my environment that which I didn't want. I didn't know that then. It took me many, many years to unravel that. You know, for any kid out there that's getting bullied, I just want you to know that, you know, it probably started at home. Either mom bullies dad, or dad bullies mom, or dad bullies other people, or mom bullies other people, or there's just a tremendous disrespect. In many cases, the bullying starts at home, and you may be bullied yourself, as I was. I was bullied at home first, and then I took that wounding out into my environment. You know, I walked with my head down. I walked, I had a chip on my shoulder, and, you know, it made me stand out. You know, it absolutely made me stand out. So bullies like zoned in on me. Like it was me. It was like truly like a moth to a flame. So, you know, if you are getting bullied, one of the things I want you to be aware of is that it's not your fault. It's what you've been tuned up to, and it's part of your life. Like it truly is a defense mechanism. Like you're so used to being picked on at home that you know that if you don't stay aware, you could get attacked at any moment. So you take that hypervigilance and that survival skill out into the world, but unfortunately, it makes you a target. And I know that might be hard to hear, but just don't do anything with it right now. Just file it. Later on, when you become an adult and you have more choices and you have more options, because you'll have more freedom, you know, eventually no one will be the boss over you, which is really, really good news. You know, this situation, you know, living at home, if it's a difficult situation and dad's an alcoholic or your stepdad's an alcoholic or mom is or your stepmother is or whatever, or if you're living with people who are addicted, it's a temporary situation. And there's going to be a time when you have learned enough that and you're strong enough and smart enough that you're going to be able to move out of that situation which does not serve you, which is something that you're really going to hold on to. You have to understand that this is a temporary situation. When I was 12, I put a gun to my head because life had gotten really, really murky, and I didn't want to live anymore. And it's looking back, it's not that I wanted to die. I wanted the pain to stop. I wanted some relief. There was never any relief. I had a very stressed relationship with my mom. My father was the one that we had to keep calm. I knew I couldn't go to him with how I felt because that would tick him off, and he didn't want to tick my mother off. My mother didn't want to tick him off. Very enabling situation. And so I knew I couldn't go home and tell them what was on my heart. I knew I couldn't talk to my mom about my dad, and I couldn't talk to my dad about my mom. And I was bullied in school to the point it was horrific. And it was torture. It literally was torture. And by the way, like, I don't get dodgeball. Like, can we take dodgeball out of schools? Because it is nothing but controlled, supervised bullying. It's ridiculous. The strongest kids always get the ball, and the weakest kids always get hit and abused. I mean, the bullies don't go after the other strong kids. They seek out the weak. And so we really need to eliminate dodgeball completely out of high schools and grammar schools. It's just ridiculous. And you can't tell me the teachers didn't see me getting my head slammed time after time. You can't tell me my teachers didn't know I wasn't being bullied on the court. You can't tell me that. I know that. I'm sorry. I went off on a tangent. But when I was 12 years old, you know, I was getting bullied at home, went to school, and I got tortured and humiliated day in and day out. And this one day, I just couldn't take it anymore. And the only thing, I was humiliated in front of an entire seventh grade, or it was eighth grade at the time. And I just couldn't face going back to school the next day. And I thought, I know, I'm going to go home and kill myself. I know where my dad's gun is, and I'm just going to end this right now. And it was the only thought that got me through that the rest of that day. It sounds strange, but people who are out there who understand that feeling of relief that comes when you think about suicide will understand. I floated home that day. I don't remember walking home. It was like I was in a cloud, and the thought of suicide just took me home. And I knew exactly where my dad's gun was, and I went into the bedroom, and I picked it up, and I put it to my head, and I looked in the mirror, and I started to weep like I've never wept before. And it was the first time that I ever saw me. And people who have never been validated will understand what I'm talking about. When you've never, no one has ever showed you any type of empathy. When you see self and you acknowledge self in a mirror or in a letter, when you read back a letter that you've written and it's full of your pain, you know, in this case, my reflection, you know, encompassed my pain. And when I saw myself, I had empathy for myself. And it was like self source self, and I just started to weep even more. And then I heard this voice say to me, Lisa, put the gun down. One day you'll show them. And suddenly I just started getting these visions of myself in a casket and my schoolmates walking around my casket, and I saw my mother holding my body and my brain splattered all over a bedroom wall. And I thought about the first moment my dad would hear that I killed myself, and then I thought about what that would do to my sister and my brother. That would label them, and they would get bullied more, and I wouldn't be there to protect them. And then it was just, it became impossible for me to kill myself. I just couldn't do it. And I put the gun down, and I sunk to the floor, and I cried some more and cried some more. And then I got this sense inside of me, like, I can't be bad. There must be something inside of me that's worthy, because I'm going to go to school tomorrow, and I'm going to take this abuse because I love my family too much to hurt them with my suicide. And it was the first time that I felt true worthiness and also appreciation for the self that had been ignored. It was the first time that myself validated self, and it felt so good and felt so amazing. At the same time, it was frustrating and it was frightening, because I thought, holy sugar, I got to go to school tomorrow and face these terrible, you know, people who have no compassion and or empathy for the very delicate creature that I am. But I did it because out of love. I did it out of love for my family, and I knew that they would never know. They would never know the cross that I carried for them, but it was okay for me. I didn't mind it. I felt like I had a purpose. And then in that moment, in those moments, it was a very miraculous day, I started to realize that it was temporary. High school was coming. I knew I had 4 years ahead of me, and then in my mind, I was gone. I was out of that house. I was going to be making my own money. And I was going to leave all this nonsense behind me. And that was my goal. And that became really became my focus. I began to understand that my grammar school and high school situation was temporary. So all of you out there who are struggling as children, it's temporary. There's going to be a time when you're going to be able to claim your right to feel and to be. And that's in the future, but you have to get through now. You have to get through the pain of today. Now, to all the adults out there that who have already made a mess out of their life like I did, hello, you know, who are struggling with these codependence issues, I want you too to also hold on and know that if you stay committed to staying self-aware and seeing your own issues and claiming what you're doing wrong, in other words, if you're enabling, claim it. Stop enabling. You know, start taking responsibility for self. If you've attracted people into your life because you've wanted them to need you, then take inventory of that. Like, take accountability for that. Your life is going to start to get a little bit messy and uncomfortable, and you're definitely going to be pushed to the edges of your comfort zone and out of them, because you don't know who you are outside of fixing other people. And that's what codependent recovery is about. And that's what I'm all about. That's what I've committed my life to, because there really isn't enough information out there about how to truly give people the tools they need to fix their thoughts, because that's where this process needs to begin. It's within your thoughts process. Your unconscious belief systems must be seen. You must see the belief systems that are fueling your thoughts and your behavior. If you don't see the corrupt data, then you can't fix it. I mean, if you have a computer and it's corrupted, then you get someone in that can figure out where this virus is in your computer and eliminates it and cleans it out, and then you start all over and then you reprogram the computer. Your computer, your brain is corrupted. Why? Because the data you received when you were being programmed is corrupt, because the people who were programming you were corrupt. It makes complete sense. And so without a true brainwashing and without a true upheaval, without a true, like, a reckoning and seeing what's wrong, then you can't be reprogrammed. You have to face all of it first, figure it all out, and then start laying down new tracks in your mind that are going to help you move forward and not make the same mistakes all over again. So that's what healing your unconscious codependent belief systems are all about. So, that's pretty much what I wanted to touch upon today. I'm going to reiterate again where I'd like people to gravitate towards, you know, in an effort to help awaken them and keep them awakened and not let them, you know, not allow yourself to fall between below the gossamer's veil any longer. It's time to wake up. We're all born divine. We're all born reflections of God. But unfortunately, our psychology has screwed us up. What we've learned has screwed us up. But, you know, take all of that away. Take all the dysfunction away. Below all of it, we're perfect. We're perfect. It's not about creating ourselves. It's about remembering who we truly are. Remember who you are. Wake up. You are perfect and you're divine. And you don't need to take care of other people in order to be worthy. You are worthy. You came into this universe worthy and divine. You just have to remember who you are. And I hope that this radio broadcast has inspired you, and I hope that it has reached the people that it's needed to reach. My name is Lisa A. Romano. I am a life coach. I'm the Long Island life coach, as I have been called and labeled by my clients. I am an ACO advocate and emotionally recovery specialist, and I am passionate about healing the world globally, one mind, one thought at a time. My website is www.healingselfesteem.com. On Twitter, I am Lisa A. Romano 1. My YouTube channel is the same, Lisa A. Romano 1. I encourage you to read my books, The Road Back to Me, My Road Beyond the Codependent Divorce, and Loving the Self Affirmations. Namaste to you all.